from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, a record 27.3 million Latinos are eligible to vote this year. That's according to the Pew Research Center. And with over half those voters expressing dissatisfaction of pollsters with the nation's direction, they could have a big impact at the ballot box this month. But experts say a history of low voter turnout and concentrations in non-battleground states haven't given Latino voters the punch their numbers might suggest. We'll discuss the potential impact of Latino voters in the presidential race and local and congressional races. Join us for Forum. It's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And in this Forum Hour, we turn our attention to what is often described as the Latino vote. A record 27.3 million Latinos are eligible to vote this year, though the number of potential Latino voters in California and other more contentious battleground states are high, turnout has traditionally been low. What will this upcoming election bring in the way of Latino turnout and impact? And what is being done to increase voter engagement? What issues also matter to Latino voters? And do millennial Latino voters care about different issues than their parents or grandparents? I want to take all that up and more in the second hour of this morning's Forum program. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. Lisa Garcia Bedoya is a Chancellor's Professor of Education and Political Science at UC Berkeley, author of, among other books, Latino Politics and Mobilizing Inclusion, Transforming the Electorate Through Get Out the Vote Campaigns. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. Also glad to have Mike Madrid, who is in Sacramento. He's editor and publisher of California City News and a principal at Grassroots Lab. He served as the press secretary for the California Assembly Republican leader and as the political director for the California Republican Party. Mike Madrid, good to have you. Welcome. Do we have Mike Madrid?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can. Thank you. For a moment there, you had me apprehensive. Great to have you.
Great to be with you.
Let me begin, Lisa Garcia Bedoya, with you. And I don't want to get too into the weeds here, but a lot of people, I said what's being called the Latino vote because there are people who have concerns about lumping all of the different, let's say, even use a word like Hispanic, it's loaded. And people say, who does that include? And why do we use that word? Because you have people of so many different races from so many different nations and different dialects and so forth and so on. Is it appropriate to call this the Latino vote?
Well,
as an umbrella?
Unfortunately, the umbrella is sort of all we have, but it is important to appreciate that that umbrella includes a lot of heterogeneity by national origin. Although two-thirds of Latinos in the United States are of Mexican origin, the remaining third come from many countries in Latin America. You also have significant differences in terms of generational status, people who are newly arrived, people whose family has been here for, you know, since it was not part of the United States. And then you have differences in terms of language use. And then regionally, there are important differences even among Mexican Americans, as an example. If you grow up in Texas, you have a very different experience than if you grow up in Florida or if you grow up in California. And so appreciating that there are some similarities across, but that you're really talking about very different kinds of people across the United States.
With different agendas, with different concerns and so forth. But nevertheless, it's something that's always had metrics behind it. Latino voters, as they're described, are more likely undecided through the years, but more expected to vote in 2016. And there are a lot of wags who think this is due to Trump. This is a sleeping giant that never seems to have quite awakened for many reasons that have been given, lack of political concern, lack of civics background, lack of engagement. Do you expect the turnout to be that much greater in this election because of Trump?
I don't. I think it's important to appreciate that feeling insulted does not automatically translate into political activity, that something else has to happen in between those two things. So while there are people who, because they already feel like the political system is a place where they can engage and should engage and make meaningful change in their lives, hearing the rhetoric from this campaign will in fact affect their political behavior. If you don't feel engaged or you don't feel like you can make a change through the political system, then this kind of rhetoric will only make you feel less engaged. And that's why it's so important in this election for there to be door-to-door campaigns and the kinds of grassroots mobilization to help people take these negative feelings and feel like the political system is a place where they can put them. And I think this presumption that there's an automatic mobilization effect is wrong.
And we'll hear about what some people are doing to do just what you've described. But you've got nearly half of the so-called Latino vote millennials, and there are big splits in terms of, say, one demographic versus that demographic. I mean, the main demographic being those beyond the age of the millennial status.
Well, 44% of millennials in the United States are of Latino origin, and they are much less likely to turn out than other Latinos, than other millennials, I should say. And so I think it's important to appreciate that we have a socialization problem in the United States. So the fact that you have Latino turnout being so low and Asian American turnout is also low. So the two immigrant origin communities in the United States have the lowest turnout. And that suggests that it's not just about personal interest or personal proclivities, but in fact, the way in which people are brought into the system. And that's especially evident among our young people. And so the fact that millennials are so disengaged among Latinos should be of concern, especially in California, because they make up so many of our young people and tell us we need to be thinking about how to organize our politics a little differently to make people feel like they should have a voice.
Well, one of the things that perhaps reflects that split that you just mentioned in California best is that there is a decided dramatic split between those who support Prop 64 among the older Hispanics, as they're called, or Latino voters, and those who want it, essentially want pot legalized for recreational use. It does go along a demarcation of age. Let me bring Mike Madrid into this, again, who's editor and publisher of the California City News. Let's just go to the chase here in terms of the presidential election, if we could, with you, Mike Madrid. Do you agree with Lisa Garcia Bedoya that it's probably not going to be that much of a change in turnout?
Well, I think she's characterized a lot of things very, very accurately. And I think the underlying causes as to why we're not seeing turnout, I think she, again, was very spot on. Look, I do believe that we are going to see record Latino turnout, but it's not nearly what it should be. And the other question is it going to be sustainable going forward? What we've seen historically is that when the Latino community feels that it's under attack, there is a response, and it seems to be kind of this short burst of mobilization, speaking exactly to what Lisa was describing, is if you feel insulted, if you feel attacked, there might be an immediate response, but it doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to engage in a system where you don't feel welcome. And so we saw this play out in California. In the mid-1990s, there was a spike in registration. There was a spike in naturalization of people who had been here and were eligible to become citizens but maybe didn't feel the urgency. They did during Pete Wilson's tenure as governor during Prop 187 in that kind of infamous election campaign. That really was, I think, a catalyst for Latino mobilization. What we saw very shortly thereafter, though, was this precipitous decline in both registration and, most importantly, turnout. And that really – that sleeping giant kind of went into a coma for 2 decades. It really – we were not seeing the rate of increase in registration mobilization that you would expect with an exploding population. And up until this election cycle, we haven't really seen the resurrection of that vote. And so I think the question as to whether or not Latinos will show up this year, I think they will. I think it will be record turnout. I don't think it will be a tsunami of voters. My longer question and concern is it sustainable, or are we going to go back into a 20-year slumber?
Well, you would think that the catalyst, if two-thirds of Latino voters are Mexican, somebody talking about rapists coming over the border and eating tacos to show that he's disposed toward friendliness to Mexican people, that sort of thing would outrage and would actually put fire into them to get out and vote. What I hear from both of you is don't have great expectations here. Let me also go, since you're Republican, to the fact that Republicans for a long time have been after the Latino vote, and that's been no secret. I mean, certainly Marco Rubio being a good example of how they felt his changes on immigration, Jeb Bush's changes on immigration. Now you've got a candidate who seems to be hostile to immigration. You would think, as I said, that would be more mobilizing.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say seems to be hostile. I think there's overt hostility coming from the candidate. Look, the Republican Party really was at a precipice during this primary season, and the party could have gone in either one of two directions, kind of the what I call the Texas model, where you have had historically politicians and governors that were very welcoming, very engaging with the Latino community. You had Marco Rubio. You had Jeb Bush. You had some real opportunities here. Conversely, you had the Donald Trumps and people who began to emulate him as they saw his success with the type of rhetoric, the build the wall, the rapists, the drug dealers, the Mexico not sending their best. And because of, I think, some of the demographic changes that are really gripping not just the country but especially the Republican Party, you saw the party take a very, I think, dangerous turn, and one that is not going to be to its long-lasting benefit.
Do you think when you think about, say, the lineage from Pete Wilson being governor here in California and Proposition 187, which really changed the whole political landscape, particularly against Republicans, that there's some way that Republicans, who once were a major force in the state, and, you know, governorship of Richard Nixon and then Ronald Reagan, that Republicans can regain that ground?
Well, California is a very different place than the rise of Nixon and Reagan and kind of the home of conservatism, at least as it was defined over the last 50 years. There's a couple of things that make it different. And the first thing that we have to understand is, while it's absolutely true that those anti-immigrant campaigns and Pete Wilson specifically were characterized as very anti-Latino, and that mobilized a generation of new Latino voters, the demographic realities that we face here in California, but even now nationally, are such that we have to remember that there has never been an immigrant group who has come to this country for economic reasons and voted in any meaningful way with the Republican Party in the first or even second generation. Now, there have been immigrant groups that have come for political reasons, Cubans specifically, Vietnamese, anti-communism, fleeing communism, for example, voted, immediately with the Republican Party. But those are very small exceptions. Since Ellis Island, we've never seen immigrant groups and even their children vote for the conservative party. And that's just part of our history as a country. So to expect anything different, I think, is a little bit foolhardy. That's just the data doesn't bear that out.
Yeah, but you've got Latinos who've been here for generations who still tend to flock to the Democratic Party.
Not many. The people that have been here since that predate the country's history, for example, are a small, small fraction of the population. And I'm not trying to dismiss what you're saying. It's true. But the natural progression we see when people come in and kind of assimilate and are politicized into the quote-unquote mainstream, you started to see by the third generation a movement towards the Republican Party, a movement towards more conservative politics. That has been stunted. There's no question about it. But we also have to understand the realities of those that are recently migrated do not affiliate with the conservative party. As I tell my Republican friends, immigrants don't come to America looking for a capital gains tax cut. That's not what immigrants are looking for. And the Republican Party needs to do a better job of addressing and welcoming immigrants if it's going to have a hope of being a party of relevance in the future.
We're talking with Mike Madrid and Lisa Garcia Bedoya, and I want to bring Fernand Amandi into this discussion as well as Ben Monteroso. I'll tell you who they are as soon as we go to them. But I want to go to something else here that I think is of preeminent importance in this whole discussion. And let me go to you first, Lisa Garcia Bedoya, and then hear what Mike Madrid has to say. And that is getting Latinos more involved on the local level. I mean, just getting them involved in terms of being on school boards or getting more elected to superintendent positions of schools, those kinds of things.
Well, in fact, most Latino elected officials in the United States serve on school boards. If you look at the data from the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, or NALEO, that's actually where people are involved. And in fact, we see here in California, we have a whole network of really powerful community organizations that, in fact, do that sort of work. And it's quite effective in terms of making that kind of engagement directly related to what people care about day to day. But I do want to make a brief comment about the question of party identification, and I want to be sure that we understand that Latino policy positions are fundamentally different than what the Republican Party supports. And so on average, and again, appreciating this is a heterogeneous community, Latinos say that they believe in social services. They say that they believe in healthcare. They believe in unions. They believe in a lot of things. And so for the Republican Party to actually get Latino voters, even those that are third and fourth generation, they're actually going to have to change their policies. And that's what they chose not to do after the 2012 postmortem. And that's why we have the candidacy of Donald Trump.
Let me pick up that for a moment, because we do have Fernand Amandi. I want to hear from Mike Madrid on this as well, but we have Fernand Amandi on the phone from Miami, and he's principal in Ben Dixon and Amandi International. They're a multilingual and multi-ethnic polling firm. They're based in Miami, and I can't necessarily talk about Miami in terms of the East Coast and Republicans, but Miami, in fact, we just did a show with Dave Barry, and I'm convinced, like he is, that Florida is almost like a state unto itself. What do you sense down there now, though, Fernand Amandi? I mean, in terms of the Republican voters, I mean, it's been so close. Every poll is showing razor-thin closeness in terms of support for Trump or being against Trump. What's your sense?
Well, first off, it's a pleasure to be here. And to your point about Miami being kind of a different place, the old joke goes that the great thing about Miami is how close it is to the United States. It's a little bit of a different environment down here. But yeah, I mean, the polls have really tightened, not just in Miami, but in the state of Florida, really, in the last few weeks. But if you look at South Florida, which is where the bulk of the Democratic base vote is for the state of Florida, an interesting phenomenon is taking place here. And I think one of the panelists had mentioned earlier the impact of the Cuban vote. Initially, the Cuban vote was almost uniformly leaning towards the Republican Party, and to the extent that the Republicans had a base vote in the Hispanic vote across the country, it was the Cuban electorate. But as you've seen that electorate transform and change, it's gotten a little bit younger. It's also gotten a little bit more diverse. Those arrivals that have come from Cuba to the United States since the Mariel boatlift in the late 1980s, many of those don't identify as much with the Republican Party, and you're seeing more of them open up to the Democratic Party, and it's really made Florida a competitive state again, perhaps the country's most competitive. But what we've seen happen in the last 10 years is an interesting phenomenon that California was really the forerunner for. It used to be because of the Cuban vote that the Hispanic vote in Florida went uniformly Republican, and as such, Florida was a reliably Republican state in presidential elections. But in 2008, the harbinger and the change happened. The Hispanic vote went for Barack Obama and the Democrats. It's been going that way ever since. And that's why, in spite of the fact that the polls are close right now, I still continue to believe Hillary Clinton will win Florida. And it's because you're seeing stronger Hispanic turnout and they're all voting for Democrats.
Wouldn't you think, though, that certainly it seems counterintuitive to the notion that many people have that there was anger when Barack Obama opened the doors to relations with Cuba. In fact, for a long time, there was anticipation that this would be seriously against any politician who moved in that direction. But somehow what you're suggesting is there was much more openness to the idea and, in fact, maybe even embracing or accepting.
Indeed, there was. I mean, our firm has done opinion studies of the Cuban American population in the United States. And, you know, to my astonishment, even at the 1 year anniversary of the normalization efforts on December 17, 2015, for the first time, a clear majority of Cubans nationally supported the policy. And as much as this would have been anathema and it would have been a steep political price had this kind of move been done in the 80s, 90s, or maybe even at the early part of the turn of this new 21st century, attitudes have shifted, and I think for a variety of reasons. One is just the recognition that after 50-plus years, the policies of isolation and non-engagement have really done little to eliminate the Castro totalitarian dictatorship from Cuba. And more importantly, those newer arrivals from Cuba that I mentioned and younger Cuban-Americans born in this country feel that in punishing the Cuban people through that policy of non-engagement was really maybe not the best approach. So you haven't really seen that issue be the third rail that it certainly was and would have been 15, 20 years ago.
Fernando Amandi, again with us from Miami. Ben Dixon, he's a principal in Ben Dixon and Amandi International, a multilingual and multi-ethnic polling firm based in Miami. And we thank you so much for joining us this morning on the Forum program.
My pleasure.
Let me go back to you, Mike Madrid. And what Lisa Garcia Bedoya said about having Latinos now on school boards and superintendents in every state. But there's still this concern about getting more involved in local positions and running for local positions and establishing themselves politically. Let's hear what you have to say about that.
Well, I think the premise of what she said initially was correct. I think the latter part I think is incorrect. So let me try to clarify a little bit. Our firm has actually done a lot of research with NALEO, the National Association of Latino Elected Officials, and what we found in California specifically was this. There's a dramatic underrepresentation amongst Latino office holders at every level of local government, and it's particularly pronounced and problematic at the school board level. Only 12% of all the school board members in the state are Latino. Only 15% of mayors and council members are Latino, and the numbers are even worse at the county supervisorial level. The reasons for that are manifold, but there's at least two that we can specifically point to as conclusive evidence of the problem. The first is low rates of voter turnout. In a lot of Latino-dominant neighborhoods, you have turnout levels that are so low that you're not seeing Latinos elected to those offices. In fact, our firm estimates that if Latino turnout matched those of Anglo voters, there would be a net increase of 600 mayors, council members, and school board members overnight in any given election. The problem also is one of policy concerns, and here's where I think Lisa is incorrect. She started by saying that Latinos are, you know, there's a tremendous diversity, but then kind of pivots back and says, you know, they're uniformly opposed to the Republican Party. I think they may be opposed to the party brand. That's undeniable. But the issues matrix, I think, is part of the reason why we have such low turnout. Is what Latinos feel, and data has borne this out for 20 years, Latinos feel that the Republican Party, quite correctly, has been openly hostile. But the Democratic Party doesn't offer any solutions for it. So why should we vote? So there's this general disengagement, and to simply try to put this into partisan terms, I think is part of the problem. It's part of the disaffection. You have Latinos overwhelmingly say we want school reform. We want more teacher accountability. We want better outcomes from our education. That's not available to them in the Democratic Party right now.
Well, there's also something else I think that has to – if I can jump in for a moment here – that has to be seen in terms of disengagement, especially when we're talking about the presidential election. You've got, for the most part, more than half of the Latino population, or was designated as a Latino population, in non-battleground states, California, New York, Texas. And certainly makes a difference in terms of people feeling my vote's going to make a difference, doesn't it?
That's a very big problem. Almost half of the Latino vote is both in Texas and in California, which are essentially decided states. Florida is the great exception, of course, because it has the most diverse Latino population in the country, first of all. It is a battleground state. Where you are starting to see Latinos make a difference is in states like Nevada, Arizona, North Carolina, a lot of these states that were traditionally red that are moving towards the blue column. As these Latino registrants come online and are overwhelmingly voting for the Democratic Party, it's putting a lot more states in play.
Yeah, indeed. And we'll talk about that some more. We'll also talk about how Latino voters are being essentially urged to go out and be more active citizens and exercise their franchise and find out. There's lots of things going on. There's a just to update you for a moment. There's a new app, in fact, that is out there. There's a Lin-Manuel Miranda of Hamilton fame started a whole campaign, a bilingual video campaign, and there are grassroots efforts. And we'll hear about a lot of that. But we'd also like to hear from you and those of you who are concerned about this voting population and how it can be turned around. It's been a sleeping giant for many years now, as we've said, and certainly both parties would like to awaken that sleeping giant. If you have some thoughts, some reflections, we'd like to hear from you. If you have questions or comments, we'd like to hear from you. And let me tell you how you can join the program. Our toll-free number is available, and that number is 866-733-6786. I'd like to get to two basic questions and thoughts from you, our listeners. Why the turnout is so low traditionally and may, in fact, get a jolt this time, but not necessarily a big one. They're often called Olympic voters. They vote every 4 years, but not in the vast numbers that they could and perhaps in many people's minds should or would if they were moved in the right direction. So join us and let us know your thoughts about that and also about increasing that vote, especially here from some Latino listeners. Again, you can join us by phone 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And you can also go to our Facebook page. We do welcome your involvement and encourage it. So please feel free to be part of the program. Talking now with Lisa Garcia Bedoya, and she's Chancellor's Professor of Education and Political Science, UC Berkeley. Mike Madrid, editor and publisher of the California City News. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about Latino votes and how they may affect this year's elections. A record 27.3 million Latinos are eligible to vote this year. That's according to Pew Research. But experts say a history of low voter turnout and concentrations in non-battleground states haven't given Latino voters the punch their numbers might suggest. Lisa Garcia Bedoya is with us, professor of education and political science at UC Berkeley and author of Latino Politics and Mobilizing Inclusion. And Mike Madrid with us from Sacramento is editor and publisher of the California City News and a principal at Grassroots Lab. He served as the press secretary for the California Assembly Republican leader and as the political director for the California Republican Party. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us by phone 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. I want to get Ben Monterroso into this. He's executive director of Mi Familia Vota, which mobilizes Latino voter participation nationally, but focuses largely on six states. And we've been mentioning Arizona and Florida and Nevada, which are definitely big states in terms of this national election, but also on Texas and California. And Ben Monterosso, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, I want to ask you first about Arizona, because there's been at least a lot of talk about a major turnaround there since 2010, when that rather, as many saw, draconic anti-immigration bill was in place. You've had some real success there in terms of numbers, and in terms of partisanship, it's almost as if Arizona's been maybe turning more blue.
Well, I think that Arizona is turning more progressive. I don't know if blue is the right thing, but that's more progressive. I think that the voters are demanding that candidates who are running for office, they just don't count as for the vote, but they want to make sure that they do policies that are going to impact our community. And you're right. I mean, after SB 1070 in Arizona, we predicted that was going to happen the same thing that happened in California after the 187. So a lot of people said California changed, and I said, no. California didn't change. We changed California, and that's what I mean. We the voters and the Latino community changed California.
Well, it may be changing Arizona, too. I mean, the First Lady was in Phoenix. There was a grand reception for her, and the real question in many people's minds remains, I've got the two main guests here this hour who feel that the Trump effect, particularly on Latino voters of Mexican descent, will not necessarily be that major. What are your feelings?
Well, I mean, I have a lot of respect for the two, Mike and Elisa, and I definitely think that what we are seeing is Donald Trump made our community to understand that elections have consequences in the national level. We have never before have had a Donald Trump like candidate running for a major political party that has insulted our community in so many different ways. That it's hard not to pay attention to that. I think that what we saw, and we have seen the differences in California, Pete Wilson and Rosa Pierce in Arizona, and neither one of those two candidates or political people are no longer in office.
But forgive me, Ben, there's a big difference between, you know, paying attention and going out and voting. You're saying that you think it's not only had effect in Arizona, you think that effect is going to be significant in terms of the presidential election?
Oh, definitely. I think that this is to me.
You got 18 electoral votes we're talking about, yeah.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is I think that I believe that we have seen increase of participation in three different levels for the Latino community, and not only in California and Texas, as a lot of our community lives there. But, you know, quite frankly, we have seen more people becoming citizens as a result of the political discourse going on now. More people registered to vote, which is something important that you saw, or we saw, at least I saw in California and Arizona, is the youth getting engaged nationwide. So I see that in the six states that I happen to have the operations with me, Familia Vota, that more youth are getting engaged. And I think that is not only good for the Latino community, but it's also good for America, and most importantly, good for the democracy of this country. We cannot have democracy without participation. So I just think that the more Latinos participate, the better democracy is going to be.
Well, participation may indeed get a boost here. I'm wondering, though, since your organization does work also in Nevada, borders California here, there's a lot of talk about Latinos voting for Trump out of self-interest, the fact that they identify him with the possibility of more jobs.
Well, I have a lot of respect for the polling that is going on, but we talk to people on a daily basis. And it's not what we find on the doors. It's not what we see people motivation to participate is. But obviously, the best poll is going to be November 8th and November 9th when we see the results. But I definitely have confidence that there are a couple of states that the Latino community will make, that the Latino vote will make a difference. And I definitely know that Arizona is one where people are looking into it. We started in Arizona with the goal of doing 75,000 voter registrations, and we ended up with doing 145,000 voter registrations. The same thing happened in Nevada, and more people registered to vote, and the DHS reports that out of the increase of the people who became citizens, 64% is in Nevada. So I expect that having the Latino participation is going to ensure that the right candidates will be elected.
Well, you know, I mentioned we're talking about Monterosso, who's executive director of Mi Familia Vota. I mentioned before we went to the break that there are lots of things that are on the scene on new technology, the Latino Vote app, Lin-Manuel Miranda putting out a bilingual video campaign, and more attempts at grassroots outreach and voter engagement attempts to get voters more engaged through outreach and through grassroots and simply working on the ground. Have these been fairly sizable factors in your judgment in terms of changing the number who are going to turn out or likely to turn out?
I definitely expect, like I said, we have seen increases of the community participation this last 18 months of this campaign. I started in June when Mr. Donald Trump decided to run for office and insult in our community at the same time. I have seen increase in three different levels, and we're still working very hard. We're not going to stop working in spite of the early voting results. We have seen increase in voter registrations. We have seen increase in people becoming citizens, and we have seen a lot of increase on volunteer and youth engagement on this. And if the early vote is an indication of the that it's not just talk but it's action on the participation, I do expect that at least, in my opinion, Naleo indicated that, you know, we hope that we were expecting to get at least 13.1 million Latinos voting, which will be a 17% increase from what we did in 2012. I agree with your comments before that we're not voting at the numbers that we need to do, but we are growing, and I think this election is just going to put us in a pot to grow even faster.
Ben Monterosso, thank you for joining us. Appreciate your being with us on the forum program this morning. And again, Ben Monterosso is executive director of Mi Familia Vota, which mobilizes Latino voter participation nationally and focuses on six states: Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, Nevada, and Texas. We're going to go to your phone calls here. Just want to mention that when we talk about the so-called Latino vote, it gets complicated. As certainly both of our guests have been saying, it tends to certainly skew more Democratic. But when you add in the fact of, I was talking before about the split between millennials and the older generation in terms of here in California, Prop 64 and legalizing pot for recreational use, there are also big splits as there are among millennials and people who are older on issues like gay marriage and abortion. And many of the Latino voters, of course, are Catholic and are very strongly against abortion and against gay marriage. I'm looking at a tweet from Adriana who says, "Latinos don't just care about immigration. We care about the environment, education, and foreign policy. These motivate all ages." And here's another listener, Sam, who writes, "I'm a 35-year-old father, husband, and career artist living in San Jose. My family has been here for four generations. Traditionally, they have not voted, and I'm not sure why. I have decided to vote this time around because the issues seem very urgent, but more importantly, I have become more educated on the details of several propositions and policy through NPR. Thank you for that. The other reason is that it's easier to approach the voting process with all of the available information." So let's go to your phone calls, and let me begin with a caller from San Jose. Andres, morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Michael, for taking the for dedicating this time to talk about this very important issue. I feel that the media doesn't really cover it, and so I appreciate the fact that you're doing this. One of the things that I wanted to bring out is my experience as an executive director of the Bay Area Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials. One of the things we've noticed here is that the unfortunate reality is that we lack the low voter turnout leads to a self-fulfilling prophecy where we wind up not getting institutional support, and so other folks wind up from communities who've risen up or finally awoken, who wind up getting all the support and the attention from the establishment. And so that makes it quite more difficult to get people elected. Just anecdotal examples are here in South Bay, where some Latinos had to step up and run insurgent campaigns, and they were able to make it off to the runoff, and now they've been able to attract support from the institutions. And so we see that throughout the Bay Area. And it's a concern, and we're trying to figure out how it is that we can work through this and be able to move beyond that situation where the community is somewhat dormant.
Well, we thank you for the call and appreciate hearing from you. That's Andres, who joined us over the transom here. Let me get another caller from San Jose on this. Tarang, good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, hi, Michael. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to the issues, and yeah, a lot of it's about education, but fundamentally, and I'm not Latino, but fundamentally, when you look at the ballot paper is so intimidating that I know as a first migrant to the U.S., I know my parents, there's no way they would look at that ballot paper and vote. Fundamentally, that ballot paper is just puts people out, and so they're not going to invest the time.
I think you make an important point here, and especially because a lot of Asian American numbers are low too in terms of turnout, particularly immigrants. African American numbers tend to be much higher than both. But Lisa Garcia Bedoya, he's got a good point there. I mean, the ballots can be very intimidating.
Absolutely. It's 226 pages, I believe, this time, 225.
It's a tome.
It is. And getting good information about how to navigate that tome is quite difficult. And that's why, and I want to make clear what I was saying at the beginning in terms of Latino turnout, and I'm sure Ben will agree with me, is that absent mobilization, absent outreach, absent information, it's difficult to think that just having a candidate who's being insulting and racist is going to lead to turnout. And so what we need is more of an investment in helping voters onboard into the system, helping them get the information they need, and help them feel confident about the vote. Because at least what I found in my work is that Latinos care about voting so much that often they fear making a mistake, and they'd rather not vote than make a mistake. And so having that high quality information about what is really at stake and how it matters to their lives. And I appreciated the first caller, Andres, making the connection. We vote for governance, right? We vote for public policies, and really being able to understand the ways in which the connections, the way the vote connects to real change and real issues that people care about. That's what we need to do in order to make people engage in the process.
And let me thank the caller. Let me also go back, Mike Madrid, to you, because we've been talking about the attempt to mobilize voters, Latino voters, and a lot of this is associated with Democrats. But the Koch brothers have funded an initiative called the Libre Initiative that's being done through Republicans. It's, again, trying to get more outreach, trying to get more Latinos to the polls. Can you tell us anything about successes or failures?
Well, I can't tell you anything about it specifically. I'm not involved. I don't know any more than I think anybody else reading the headlines. But what I will say is this. First of all, I think that it's healthy to see that people across the spectrum engaged in the mobilization that we're talking about. But we also need to keep in mind that at no point in our history as a community, as a Latino community or as a state, has more resources, more nonprofits, more attention, more information been focused on our community. Especially over the last 15, 16 years. And what we have seen, despite all that, is this declining record of participation, which tells us you have to take a step back and ask the question, why is that? Why do we keep doubling down on these tactical efforts, mobilization efforts that are not working? And that has led me to conclude that really what we have is a much more fundamental problem that's related more as a function of class and the economy and the ability to feel that your government is responsive to you than whether or not there's more information available, or whether Lin-Manuel is making an app. There's this unfortunate trend to try to app our way out of these problems. The problems, in my estimation, are far more fundamental.
Let me bring another caller on. And Michael, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on Forum.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just relocated from a year and a half in Miami, and most of my time in the U.S. has been in the Northeast. And I consider Miami, growing up in Kingston, Jamaica, which is third world, to me, Miami is fourth world. It's so lawless. But as it relates to this specific topic, I wonder how much your guest thinks that the wet foot, dry foot law contributes to the particular situation in Florida, because it seems to be a very dominant situation where most of the Cubans that I ask questions do vote Republican. But I also know that Florida has a lot of programs. I've met Cubans who said, well, I vote Republican because they gave me a house when I came here. And Florida was really culture shock for me. So I'm happy to be in the Bay Area, but I'm wondering how much your guest thinks the wet foot, dry foot law and Florida being Republican for so forever, it seems.
It's a good question, Michael. In fact, we still have Fernando Mondi with us from the Ben Dixon and Mondi International. Want to respond to his question, Fernando?
Sure. You know, it's been remarkable, because that was the wet foot, dry foot policy, which in essence, just for the listeners, it basically meant that if you were emigrating from Cuba and trying to find asylum in the United States, so long as you were able to reach dry ground as opposed to being intercepted at sea, whether it was in a raft or a boat, you would be repatriated back to Cuba if you were caught at sea. But if you made it to dry ground, even if it was on the shore of the beach or anywhere on the ground of the United States, you would be able to claim asylum and stay. And there has been a political resonance around that issue, to the caller's point. But what's most interesting is there is now a movement within certain aspects of the Cuban community to reverse the wet foot, dry foot, because incredibly, they're suggesting that many of these more recent immigrants from Cuba are coming more for economic reasons than political reasons, in spite of the fact that the political regime in Cuba hasn't changed since the Castros took power in the late 1950s. But part of the reason for this is also the political resonance around whether or not these newer Cuban-American arrivals aren't necessarily following the Republican orthodoxy that the historic exiles followed and voted along those lines throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s to today.
You also had the Marielito exodus, which really affected a lot of attitudes toward Cuban immigration here and Cuban settling in Florida. But I'm wondering, actually, let me follow this up with you, Fernando Mondi, about there seems to be a kind of disparity between the Naleo polls and the Pew polls, Naleo being a National Association of Latino elected and national officials that was alluded to before by Mike Madrid. The breakdown, I'll get back to what we started talking about with Lisa Garcia Bedoya. Do the Cubans tend to be different in their politics, even though they come under that umbrella of being Latino, from, Mexicans or Central and South Americans?
Indeed they are, Michael. And, you know, it's interesting because the only voter group in America right now that is of Hispanic origin, that a majority of them support Trump over Hillary Clinton, is the Cuban vote right now. Now, we'll see how that turns out in this final seven-day sprint to the elections. But right now, it's the only group of Hispanic voters in the country that I've seen in our polling, and I think it's others will attest to it as well, that more of them are supporting Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. So they very much are an outlier right now within the Hispanic electorate nationally.
Looking at a comment from George, who says, with 7 days left, what's the best way to help mobilize Latino voters? Should we give money to Mi Familia Vota or other organizations that are effectively doing outreach in battleground states? Anyone want to weigh in here? Lisa?
I would say yes, and I'm sure Ben would say yes. I would also think the major folks doing this kind of work now are Mi Familia Vota, Naleo, which has been mentioned, and then also the Immigrant Voters Win PAC, which is a PAC that was put together for this campaign. They're working in Florida, Nevada, and Colorado. I should say, for the sake of full information, I serve on the board of the organization that created the PAC. But these are the major efforts that are really in a culturally competent way going door to door and just talking to voters and really taking advantage of people's anger and channeling it in a positive way toward voter engagement in November.
And I am going to go to more calls, as I said, but let me read one more listener comment on our website. Listener writes, Latinos not voting is part of a much larger problem in the United States, a disgracefully low level of voter turnout overall. I wish the United States made voting a legal requirement. You know, what comes to my mind here, though, I must say, is the fact that the dropout rates are higher among Latinos than any single group in the United States. And that has to be, in some way, maybe part of what we're talking about in terms of the disengagement problem. Don't you think, Lisa? I mean, just the fact that not getting the education, not getting exposed to ideas, not taking civics classes, what's left of civics classes.
I think part of the problem, you've hit the nail on the head, is how we teach civics and the degree to which civics is important in immigrant households, because you don't necessarily have political socialization happening from parents. But even among higher educated Latinos, even if you control for socioeconomic status, income, education, occupation, you still have a gap. And especially among Asian Americans, you have a significant gap, what they call the Asian paradox. So I think appreciating that if our immigrant origin communities, people who've chosen to come here, have such low rates, we should be concerned for our democracy, because the America in general has low rates. And so it's more than just educational levels. It's actually how people are brought into the system.
Well, in fact, let me go to you on this, Mike Madrid. There's often it's often pointed out that people from Mexico particularly, but many of the South American states, many of those who come under the, again, the banner of Latino or Hispanic, who are here even for one generation or a couple. If there's a soccer match or something along that those lines, you'll see the flag of the native country. And you certainly hear from conservative voices, I'm sure you have, about, you know, where's the loyalty to the United States?
Yeah, look, I don't ascribe a whole lot to that. I think cultural pride is something that's very important, and I think America, you know, still exists as the one nation where that's not only acceptable but welcomed, not by all, and I don't think that's a partisan problem. I think that's an endemic American problem that we've had for, you know, 250 years of our existence. I don't know that that will change, but I think that we're going to see more and more of that. And again, I think it's a positive, healthy development. It's kind of the e pluribus unum concept that I think makes America what it is.
Could you also, Mike, do me a favor and respond to that voter engagement question that was out there?
Yeah, look, there's Lisa's right. There's no question that there is a correlation between class, economic class, and voter mobilization and civic engagement generally. And that is the one thing that we have failed to discuss. I don't care if you are poor and black in Alabama or poor and white in Appalachia or poor Latino in Los Angeles. There's a direct correlation between your economic class and whether or not you are civically engaged. That does not mean that wealthier Latinos or more educated Latinos are voting at the same participation rate as their white or Anglo cohorts. But it literally drops off of a cliff when you start getting out to the lower level of our economic status. And this is the real problem. You've just heard other guests talking about a whole litany of nonprofits that exists and PACs. There is voluminous amounts of resources and money thrown at this problem. That should tell us that we are not solving the problem because the participation rate continues to go down. This is not a tactical problem. We have a problem where there is a growing swath of our population in America, specifically in California, that is increasingly poor, that is increasingly disenfranchised, that is facing a whole social set of economic challenges that are making it a barrier to be involved in their own government, their own community, their own society. And what we do is we take the easy road of saying, well, let's create an app for that, or let's donate some money and solve the problem, or let's go door to door and canvas. None of that has been working for 20 years. At a certain point, we have to realize that the policies that we are pursuing are not working for this community. And until that problem is solved, we will not see a healthy democracy.
You want to weigh in here, Fernando Mundi?
Look, I mean, I think the caller made the point earlier, and I think the panelists made the point earlier, and we saw this so clearly in the 2012 campaign. It wasn't enough to kind of demonize one side over the other. If you want to have turnout, you have to make the case for how an election is going to have an impact on the quality of life of the voter. Participation rates seem to surge more when they understand what's on the line, as opposed to just demonizing one side or the other. This holds more true than any with Hispanic voters, and one of the concerns I think a lot of folks have about this cycle in particular, even though the conditions seem to be there and suggest there's going to be record Latino turnout, I think where the campaign has been delinquent more on the Democratic side has been in really not laying out the case on those issues beyond even immigration, jobs in the economy, education, healthcare, even foreign policy. All of these issues, there are stark choices, I think, at play. And if you can make those cases to the voters, and Latino voters especially, it's much more effective than just the demonizing of one side or the other. And even low-income voters seem to respond to that messaging a lot better.
All right, we're going to bring more callers on, and let me go to you, Dan. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Whoops. I'm sorry, we seem to have a phone issue here. We have a whole bunch of callers lined up, and I have to apologize to all of you because we're running short of time here in this hour, but we're obviously not going to get to these calls. More than again, I get back to that fact that more than half of the Latino potential voters are in non-battleground states. And so what does that mean in terms of the battleground states? What does that mean in terms of tactics to get people, especially in places like Arizona, Florida, and Nevada, out to vote? Fernando Mundi, if I could, to you again.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think one of the key elements is, and some of the panelists have touched on it earlier, you have to engage the community, particularly in language. You know, one of the new innovations in presidential campaigns over the last 15 to 20 years has been Spanish language media and communications. It's not just enough to make the case overall. You have to make the case oftentimes in language. And particularly in these battleground states where the margins of those elections in those winner-take-all battleground states could be decided by less than 4 percentage points, every single element of the Hispanic electorate is important for that turnout. And I think that's why you see states like Arizona now potentially coming into play. We've certainly seen the effect in Nevada, Colorado, and Florida, traditionally states where the Hispanic vote has asserted itself, but also North Carolina. These two states, these two new emerging states in Arizona and North Carolina, I think Georgia's also on the horizon as well. Going into the community and having the candidates themselves make direct appeals in language are just as important as doing it with the general market. And I think the campaigns and the candidates that are more sophisticated in that understanding will reap the benefits on Election Day.
Unless we forget, California may not be a battleground state, but 38.6% of total California population is under this Latino. That's nearly 7 million eligible, potentially eligible voters. I think, let me get a quick caller on here. Graciela, I think we're working now. Hi, Graciela. Are you there? No, I thought we were working. I'm sorry. We got to get our technical stuff in order here. But that actually brings us to the end of the hour. Anyway, I want to thank our guests, Lisa Garcia-Bedoya and Mike Madrid. Also, we spoke with Ben Monterroso and Fernanda Monde, who joins us from Miami, Mike Madrid from Sacramento, and Lisa Garcia-Bedoya was right here in studio with us. And thank you, our listeners, because we wouldn't be here without you. We appreciate your listenership and are grateful for it. And we remind you that you can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum. And you can also let us know what you like about what you hear on Forum or don't like by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. I want to remind you who's behind the scenes here. Forum's producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. We had Jeremy Siegel filling in for Amanda today. Thanks to Jeremy. Thanks to Danny Bringer, our engineer. And thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll. And our general manager is Joanne Wallace. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, KQED FM at 88.5 on your dial, I thank you for being a part of this morning's 2 hours. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.